Chat with Traders, episode 31.
The biggest secret of the best traders in the world is that they're just like everyone else. However, they've worked hard to learn the markets and discover what works and what doesn't. But how can you hear about these journeys and get in on the strategies and tactics they use? You can do it by listening to Chat with Traders. Here's your host, Aaron Fifield.
Hey there, what's up team? Welcome back to another episode of the Chat with Traders podcast, and you're listening to episode number 31. Now, this week I spoke with Luke Cummings. He's an Australian equities trader with 14 plus years of experience on his side. After making a last minute decision that journalism wasn't going to be a good fit for him, Luke went into a finance degree which led him to becoming a stockbroker, which then led him to becoming a trader. Nowadays, Luke remains an active trader, of course, and also operates a hedge fund based in Sydney. As well as this, he also runs a model portfolio service and trading blog, which goes by the name of The Long and Short of It. And we keep things fresh in this interview by discussing trading methods and strategies that haven't really been spoken about in previous episodes. Additionally, Luke shares some of the common traps that often catch entry-level traders and how you may be able to avoid the avoidable with some insight. For all the links and resources mentioned in this interview, all you need to do is go to chatwithtraders.com/31 and you'll be able to see all the show notes there. All right, guys, well, I hope you enjoy this interview. I'm Aaron Fifield, your host of Chat with Traders, and here is this week's guest, Luke Cummings. Hey, Luke, what's going on, man? How's your day been?
Hi, Aaron. Very well, thank you. Day's going well. Looking forward to chatting.
No doubt. That's good to hear, man. Thanks a lot for making the time to come on the show. It's really good to have you here. And there's a number of things I'm keen to speak with you about today. Of course, we all want to know about your development as a trader, sort of from day one to where you are right now. And I'm also interested to get into some details about a strategy which you regularly trade, which is a takeover strategy. It's something we haven't really discussed on the podcast in the past, and it'll be good to hear more about this. But let's kick it off with your introduction to the markets. So where did this journey as a trader begin for you?
Sure. Look, to be honest, I guess I kind of stumbled into trading somewhat. I'd had no real exposure to the share market in my younger years. Grew up in country New South Wales, which is the state of Australia for your American listeners, and moved to Sydney when I finished school, started studying at night, working in the daytime. And one of the first jobs I had just happened to be working for an international fund manager. Obviously, you know, buying and selling shares and currencies and whatnot as part of their portfolio management. It was very much an administrative-based role, so you know, my job was to help settle trades and move cash and reconcile positions and so on and so forth. So no direct exposure to the market as such, but you know, was certainly aware of some of the things that were happening in the office at the time. My next step after that was I took a job actually at an online broker, E-Trade here in Australia. I don't think I was quite 18, or maybe I just turned 18 at that stage, so I finished school reasonably young. And I was just working in their customer service division at E-Trade, which was very interesting. It was April 2000. I actually started there about a week before the NASDAQ tech crash happened. Which was, you know, quite eye-opening at the time, but really was there with no preconceived ideas about the market. Had read some books and had some, I guess, exposure at university to the market. Anyone who's kind of got a finance degree, I guess, one of the first things you get taught is that, you know, the market is efficient, at least relatively efficient. And at that stage, I really had no reason to think otherwise or to believe otherwise. Of course, having exposure to you know, people who are trading online and they're calling in and they're asking questions about the website and their positions and different things, to, I guess, sense their emotions through that period of the tech crash was very interesting, because you know, they sort of say you know, can tell a lot about a person when they're under pressure, when money's involved, and that was certainly an eye-opening experience. A colleague who I worked with there took a job at a broking firm probably about 3 years after we'd been working there, I got on pretty well with him socially. I wouldn't have said he was a great friend of mine, but you know, we'd always gotten along well, and an opportunity came up to go and work at the firm that he was working at. Part of the pretense under which we were lured there was, you know, all of these client accounts that they had that were dormant and needed servicing that weren't being serviced at the time. Seemed like a really good opportunity, and I guess the reality was when we got there that the number of clients or prospects that existed were less than we'd been led to believe. And we sort of figured out that, you know, if we're going to rely only on broking commissions for our livelihood, that we probably wouldn't be doing too well. So we also had a bit of time on our hands because, we weren't as busy as we had been led to believe. So we just sort of started looking at the market and doing a little bit of trading ourselves. Obviously, you know, we have exposure to clients who are doing something similar. And, you know, to be quite honest, one of my business partners who's still my business, or sorry, the colleague that I was talking about who's now one of my business partners, just stumbled across this thing one day and sort of said, look, I think there's an angle here. And I was like, you know, sounds great in theory, but, you know, I've been to university and I've studied finance. I know that the market's efficient and, you know, something that simple surely isn't going to work, or at least not consistently. There must be something we're missing. And, you know, I wouldn't say we paper traded in the way that people, you know, I guess think about paper trading now, but we watched a couple of these situations evolve and, you know, we're like, well, it looks like there's an angle here. And I guess we just sort of started to, you know, systemically exploit that and to look for those types of situations. And it was actually a really profitable little niche that we'd found. And I guess, you know, really that was the start of the process for me. I took that job without having any intention of being a trader. It just sort of evolved that way. And that was, I think, 2003 or 2004. And in one form or another, we've been at it ever since.
Okay, that's excellent. So I'm keen to sort of break that journey down a little bit more and touch on some of the points you mentioned. So just before I do that, though, what was it about trading that actually appealed to you, or maybe not even trading, but just the markets in general? Because, I mean, when you're young, you have the opportunity to go pretty much any direction you like in terms of your career. What was it about the markets and trading that really got your attention?
Yeah, it's a good question. I actually intended to be a journalist initially, and that was very much my plan. Right up until the time I finished school, I was going to study journalism. And at the last moment, for whatever reason, I just decided that, you know, I didn't think I wanted to be a journalist. And I really was just looking for a job, to be perfectly honest. I knew that I wouldn't have the luxury of going to university full time without working. And it just so happened that, you know, one of the first roles that I stumbled across was the job, administrative job with the fund manager that I mentioned earlier. I think, you know, once I got a little bit more exposure to the markets, though, I mean, I just think it's a fascinating thing, and I'm not sure necessarily that I thought about it in those terms at the time, but, you know, you have this thing that every single day there's something different, as in there's no, you know, set pattern to how things evolve throughout the course of the day. You know, you can be having a quiet day right now. It's, you know, 2:15 in the afternoon here in Sydney. You know, something might be about to happen in 5 minutes' time that I couldn't foresee or wasn't expecting, that, you know, could be one of the best opportunities that we have of the year. I think I was really drawn to the fact also that, you know, you can make money that isn't directly correlated to your effort, in the sense that in my school holidays, when I was still at school, I was doing some, you know, manual work like landscape gardening. My job was really to do, you know, the hard yakka, I guess, of the digging and the moving and the lifting and whatnot. And you come home at the end of every day and you're exhausted and you've earned, you know, whatever, $15, $20 an hour. But you can only earn more money by working more, and it's hard work. And then you have, you know, trading, which, of course, you need to put effort into that. And as times evolved, you know, we've developed systems and whatever else. But the idea that a little bit of effort can make you a little bit of money, or can make you a lot of money, and that you don't necessarily know in advance which it's going to be, you know, was certainly appealing to me. I think all traders probably at some level, you know, are driven by a desire to have a better life or a better lifestyle, to have money. I think somewhere along the way, the money becomes less important, actually, probably once you start to, you know, consistently make it. But I think definitely for me, you know, I didn't grow up in a wealthy household. No one in my house talked about stocks. You know, I'm not even sure that I knew anyone who
was trading or investing in stocks, at least not directly. So I think the idea that, you know, you could build a better life for yourself and that it wasn't through manual labor as such was probably, you know, at least at the time, what appealed to me.
Yeah, I really like that answer. And I think a lot of people listening, including myself, can, you know, really relate to that. So you mentioned there that you were at university and you was it an economics degree?
It was a finance degree, which I guess had, you know, an economics component, a finance component, accounting component, so on and so forth.
Okay. So you mentioned that they sort of taught that the markets were efficient, but when you sort of started trading with your partner, like you mentioned there, you were sort of seeing that the markets weren't efficient. What do you mean by efficient and inefficient sort of markets?
Sure. So I guess, you know, if you sort of think about university and finance or economics, I mean, we have this concept of the efficient market hypothesis. And really, in a nutshell, what that tells you is that in its most purest form, everything that should impact the price of a security, so whether it be a stock or otherwise, at any point in time is priced into that security. So the idea is that, you know, by knowing information about, you know, the PE multiple or the company's earnings or, you know, by looking at a chart or whatever, that there shouldn't be any discernible ongoing advantage by knowing that information because it's already in the price. Now, in its purest form, they teach you at university that, you know, it includes all known information and all unknown information, and that's, I think, called pure form efficient. And then they have this concept of, you know, semi-form efficient, which is that all public information is in the price, but, you know, information, inside information, I guess, is not in the price at that point in time. And I think, you know, sort of logically that makes sense. Certainly if you've had no reason up until that point to think otherwise, you know, at a fundamental level, to me at least, it sort of made sense. It's like, well, okay, if everyone knows that, you know, the current earnings are this, or that this company's released a new product, or, you know, that the economy is doing this, or whatever else, you know, it makes sense that, that these things are priced efficiently. Now, I think as things evolve and as you learn, you realize that, you know, that's an efficiency at a point in time is probably the argument that, you know, that is making, that concept is making. And of course, you know, prices can move as new things develop. So, you know, maybe an existing product's more successful than the company and the market had anticipated. Maybe it's less successful. Maybe, you know, there's a currency impact for one of its earnings, earnings of one of its divisions. But I actually realized, you know, very early on, or my partner and I realized that even that couldn't account for what we were seeing because every day stocks are moving really with no discernible reason for them to move. So, you know, you can make an argument that maybe information is evolving or that someone who, you know, has an incentive to buy or sell a security has learnt something new that maybe they were previously not aware of. But I think that, you know, in a lot of stocks, if they're liquid enough, that that's probably not enough to account for the reason that you see some of these securities move in the range that they move on a daily basis. And I think, you know, that combined with the fact that we'd sort of found this, you know, little niche that we were exploiting quite profitably, you know, it was really telling us that, well, you know, the market's not efficient at all, at least certainly in some respects. So I think that, you know, there are some instruments probably where you can make an argument that the market is reasonably efficient because there are so many people looking at them, and, you know, information about what drives prices is very readily available. But there's a bunch of stocks, and I'm sure other instruments as well, and stocks, I guess, is, you know, our area of expertise, that, you know, people just aren't looking at or paying attention to, or there are angles that they haven't thought of. And, you know, one thing for us, I guess, is that I've listened to some of your previous podcasts on the site, and I'm slowly working through the rest of them. But, you know, Tim Sykes was saying that you were talking to him about his edge and why he chooses, you know, small caps or penny stocks. And he sort of used the example of, you know, if you're going to play basketball, do you want to play against Michael Jordan or, you know, I'm not sure it's politically correct, but, you know, do you want to play against a midget? And, you know, it's a funny analogy because I kind of agree with him in that I think there are areas of the market that are harder to compete in. I mean, you know, if someone like Goldman Sachs is throwing all of their resources at an area that I'm trying to compete with them in, I think that's very difficult. I think, you know, where we try to play a lot of the time is in areas that, you know, Goldman Sachs probably isn't paying attention to because it's too small in terms of, you know, what it can add to their bottom line, or it's an area that, you know, these guys go to the same universities and colleges that I went to that teach you that certain things are efficient or can't exist or aren't possible. And I think that leads to them ignoring a lot of areas of the market that can actually be exploited. And I suspect that, you know, of all the people you're interviewing who are trading for a living, I mean, they all at some level believe that the market, and probably have proof that the market's not efficient, because if the market was efficient, you can't make your living trading, you know, like they do and like I do. So that was a real eye-opener for me, I guess, is that, you know, one of your other interviews, someone mentioned, you know, stages of development, and one is, you know, you're making money, but you can't figure out why, and then you're not making money, you can't figure out why, which is maybe worse, and then, you know, you're not making money, you know why, and then you're making money, and you know why, and I think that's the thing. Like, if you're making money and you really want to make a career out of trading, I think you really need to be able to put your finger on, you know, pretty quickly, at least at the point where you're going to scale up in terms of the time and, you know, financial resources that you commit to it. You've got to understand why it is that you're making money and where that advantage is coming from, because you know, randomness can account for a lot in the markets and in life, right? You do a trade that makes money, doesn't necessarily mean it was a good trade. You do a trade that loses money, it doesn't necessarily mean it was a bad trade. I think people confuse the end result of what they did with, you know, the intent that they had or the reason, you know, for them taking the trade in the first place. And I think that, you know, was important to us early on, was to try and figure out, hey, are we just lucky here, or, you know, have we actually found an inefficiency in the market? And, you know, sitting where I sit now and for some time, I definitely believe that the market isn't efficient, at least in some areas.
Okay. Yeah, that's a really great answer. And thanks for really expanding on that too. So all in all, would you say your degree from university and your experience as a stockbroker, did you find that this had any benefit to you when it actually came to trading your own money?
Look, definitely. Maybe not for the reason that I would expect, though, or that listeners would expect. I mean, the university component, I think, was really great. One, for exposing me to, you know, things in terms of terminology and concepts and whatnot that I just wouldn't have had exposure to otherwise. But once you get past that, you know, initial fundamental knowledge base, I think it's really great, you know, looking at it in hindsight, to know or understand what everybody else in the market, at least who are finance professionals who are working as, you know, portfolio managers or prop traders or whatever they're doing at all these firms, I think it's great to understand what they're taught and why their belief systems are, you know, what they are. So from a university perspective, I think that was really great. From a broking perspective, I mean, you know, I think outside looking in, you think about a customer service role at an online broker, it actually sounds like a pretty terrible job. But I have to be honest, the two business partners that I have, we all came through, you know, E-Trade at similar times. We didn't necessarily work together, but we all had that grounding or that base coming through E-Trade. And the cool thing about that was that you're not getting paid very much, but you're going to work every single day and you're learning about the market. So you're learning about how the market actually physically operates and some of the rules and regulations that govern it, and you know, some of the idiosyncrasies of the market in terms of, you know, the market itself. But then you also have the benefit of seeing human emotion, you know, in operation, more or less in real time, because you're talking to these people over the phone who are having problems, you know, have questions about whatever, but you can't help but figure out, you know, I guess what their emotional headspace is, and you get some exposure to the types of trades and things that they're doing. So, you know, I actually can't imagine being in the position that we're in right now had we not had that education, you know, in online broking, because it's basically like getting paid for 3 or 4 years to do an apprenticeship or an internship where you get to learn everything about the market. And I think, you know, the alternative to that would have been trying to learn all of that stuff at night or on weekends or before work, or, you know, in addition to having other jobs, I think would have been really difficult. Moving on to when I became an actual broker and was giving advice to people and looking after accounts, Also very interesting, I think, you know, the way people react to making profits, the way people react to making losses, the amount of opportunities you would call people with and say, hey, look, here's a really great trade. Here's the downside. Here's why I think you should do it. And, you know, their reasons for not doing it or whatever, I think is very interesting. So, yeah, if I had my time again, I think the path that all three of us took to get to where we are now was really perfect. And the other cool thing was that, you know, in the year 2000, online trading hadn't existed in this country for very long. I mean, it hadn't existed in any country for very long. A lot of the customers at E-Trade were still using dial-up internet and couldn't talk on the phone at the same time they're using their internet. And it was sort of just, you know, a crazy time. And it was kind of nice because it's not like coming into an industry where there are people with 30 or 40 years worth of experience that you don't have. You know, at most, there's probably people with a couple of extra years experience trading online than what, you know, I had at that time. So I think timing was beneficial in that regard.
Yeah, right. That's really interesting. You kind of mentioned a little bit earlier, you talked about once you did start trading, you and the partner who you were trading with came across sort of a niche or a little area, a type of trade or strategy that you could exploit, and you were making you know, decent money from this strategy you discovered. Can you talk to us a little bit about maybe how you discovered that strategy, and are you still running with that strategy today?
Yeah, sure. Look, this credit for finding the strategy definitely goes to my partner at the time. You know, I've actually never really discussed it with him in detail. I presume he just sort of stumbled across it by accident. We sort of found a way to exploit a loophole around, you know, capital raising in typically smaller cap stocks. So, you know, to get access to discounted securities, you know, that some of these companies were offering. Of course, depending on the company, sometimes, you know, no discount, frankly, is big enough to want to give them money. Other times, you know, the opportunities are attractive. So, sadly, the loophole we were exploiting no longer exists. The rules were changed such that the way we were obtaining access to them at the time no longer exists, which is a shame. But we basically went through the process of doing this ourselves. And because we were somewhat capital constrained at the time, you know, there were really two forms of leverage for us. One was to share those opportunities with our clients, which we, you know, certainly endeavoured to do as much as we possibly could, and had a lot of clients who made a lot of money from that at the time. And the second way was, you know, for us to get our hands on more capital ourselves. And I mentioned to you when we were chatting earlier that the way that we did that at the time, which I definitely do not advocate to anyone under any circumstances, is we actually used credit cards because we're young guys. Like, I was only, you know, probably 20 or 21 at that stage. And, you know, I didn't have any money. I probably still had a little bit of, you know, consumer debt from university and buying a car and all these things that you sort of do. So we sometimes were making, you know, 5, 10, 15% a month from some of these trades pretty consistently. So even if you're having to pay a bank, you know, 15, 16% a year in interest, which sort of sounds crazy saying it now, but, you know, it was a smart thing for us to do. And, you know, we'll probably get to this later on in terms of how our trading strategy has evolved through time. But, you know, one thing that, or a couple of things about that was, one, we needed to be pretty damn sure that we could make money consistently, given that we're using someone else's money. But it also made us, I think, very mindful of risk and, you know, sometimes that it's just better to take the fat, easy part of profit out of a trade without a lot of risk rather than, you know, really going for the entire amount of profit that might be in the trade. So I think if you use a baseball analogy, you know, sometimes a base hit or a double is better than a home run if you could get that base hit or the double, you know, more frequently than you would get the home run. So that was what we did. But I actually think, and I don't have proof of this, but I think the strategy we were running and the extent to which we scaled it amongst our clients, and it sort of became a reasonably well-known strategy, certainly at least within a niche in the Australian market, probably was what at least partially contributed to the subsequent rule change about that. So it was a cool little thing. And, you know, one thing we don't really know now is whether or not maybe we should have kept it a little quieter and we'd still be trading it now because it just wouldn't have become such a prominent thing. But, you know, onwards and upwards, no regrets. But it was a cool thing. If we hadn't found that, I don't think, you know, that we'd be doing what we're doing today and we wouldn't be talking about this. So that was pretty cool. And I guess the interesting thing is that sort of a long way to answer your question, but, you know, you sort of think about how people become traders and the preparation they do, and you know, maybe they go to a course. I've listened to your own interview about you know, starting out with GAN and going to a seminar and learning about that. And some people, you know, read books and learn about fundamentals, and you know, you've spoken to people on this podcast who, you know, are crazy into, like, you know, programming and backtesting and you know, different things. It sort of seemed a bit surreal that we kind of just stumbled across this thing that, you know, no one was really talking about, and it wasn't particularly sophisticated, and it was just really easy to exploit it for profit at the time. You know, that was sort of weird, because even things like having a trading plan and things, I mean, all those things come after, but all of the things that you think that, you know, you should do and that you need to know in advance to start making money in the market, you know, we weren't doing any of those things. And some of our, you know, friends and colleagues who were working at other firms and things, like, you know, big name financial firms, sort of knew what we're doing. They're like, you guys are crazy. Like, what are you wasting your time on, like, all these small, ridiculous trades for? Like, you know, what's the point? And, you know, I felt, and I think, you know, probably my business partner at the time, you know, probably felt a little bit of an inferiority complex, where it's like, yeah, when, you know, we're not really serious, as in, you know, no one's taking us serious. This is kind of a small strategy that, you know, is a bit of a niche, and it was almost embarrassing to talk to people about it. But it just became such a big thing, and we made so much money from it. And it's funny now, you know, looking back on that, and some of the people who at the time were like, you guys don't know what you're doing, you're just lucky, and, you know, loophole's going to close and that'll be it, you guys will have to get, you know, other jobs and things. You know, some of those people now are like, okay, what else have you guys got? Like, you know, tell me some other strategies, what should I be buying, whatever. And you know, I think that's been an interesting process to go through. You know, I wish I could say that we set out with intent to become professional traders and did all these cool things, and that, you know, we're super smart and great at math and all these things, but it just, for us at least, hasn't really worked out that way. And I think if I look back, you know, the fact that we weren't doing what everyone else was doing, and that you couldn't just turn up somewhere and learn what we were trading in a course or read it in a book, actually probably what made it work in some ways, because we just kind of found something that no one else was looking at the time.
Right, okay. So right at the start of that, you mentioned you were sort of purchasing discount securities. What do you mean by discount, just so we understand before we move on?
Sure. So look, in a purist example, which is, you know, not the strategy we were using at the time, but, you know, in Australia, Westpac Bank owns a fund manager called BT, or partially owns a fund manager called BT. American listeners can look it up online briefly if they want to, but we did an offer recently where they sold down part of their holding. Westpac sold down part of their holding in BT, and the reason they did that was because in Australia they're talking about changing some rules around the level of capital that banks have to hold, and you know, the penalty from a capital perspective of them continuing to hold BT, I guess in the bank's view, you know, was greater than the benefit of continuing to have the shareholding in BT that they did. So very basic level, Westpac says anyone who's an existing BT shareholder or who is an existing Westpac shareholder will have the ability to buy BT shares at a fixed price of $8.20. Now, this is for existing shareholders only. So if you, you know, don't hold shares in BT or you don't hold shares in Westpac, and you, you know, that announcement is made, then there's no way for you to participate. Many years ago, if you didn't already own those shares, sometimes they would say anyone who's a shareholder in a week or two's time, or 3 weeks' time, whatever it's going to be, will be entitled to participate in that offer. So in the case of BT, you know, which is sort of underway at the moment, you know, BT announced, or Westpac announced, they were doing that sale when the share price was $8.20 about, you know, two and a half weeks ago. Of course, we've had a lot of market volatility in that time, but, you know, the last week or so, the market's rallied pretty hard. You know, BT shares as of yesterday were almost at $10. Today they're, you know, I think about $9.50 or something. It's quite a big price gap there, right? So, you know, if you have the ability to buy BT shares at $8.20 and they're currently trading at $9.50, it doesn't really matter, you know, what you think the outlook is for BT. You don't need to want to own BT for any great period of time. You know, you're basically being offered something that's worth $9.50 today for $8.20. As long as you think that between now when you buy BT and, you know, when you're able to sell them, when your new shares are allocated, that's sort of a no-brainer transaction, right? Like, it's like me saying to you, you know, give me $8 and I'll give you 10. It's like, well, what's the catch? That seems a bit too good to be true. But it exists. And the thing is now there's no exploitable angle because, you know, the window is closed by the time that's announced. But previously that window wasn't closed. And that was something that, you know, we took advantage of as much as we could, when the rules existed in that format. So what we're basically trying to do is figure out, you know, how do we buy $10 for $8 or how do we buy $5 for $4 or whatever the case may be.
Okay, sure. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Let's fast forward to current times now and talk about how you're trading these days. So give us an overview of your approach to the markets that you apply, you know, in current times today.
Sure. So I think at a fundamental level, the premise hasn't changed for us in that we're not trading the same strategy that we were back then. But one great thing about that strategy was that the reward on offer was outsized relative to the risk that we were taking. So I think you're always taught, and you know, we talked about my university degree earlier, the idea is that to get more reward, in theory, you have to take on more risk. And I think, you know, fundamentally that's pretty well accepted. What we're really looking for are situations where we think that the reward on offer exceeds the level of risk involved in us taking that transaction. And that maybe sounds a little strange or a little crazy, but you know, the idea is the same as you know, that loophole we found before. There are other things in the market that, you know, where that exists, I think. And we really have a couple of different components to our business now. So the original business partner or colleague at the time that I mentioned, you know, they started working with, you know, more than 10 years ago, is still one of my business partners today. I have a second business partner as well who joined, you know, along the way. And the two of them primarily are focused on really short-term stuff. So non-client-facing stuff, typically day trading. We try and be, you know, pretty flat at the end of every day. And it's time-intensive, you know, every day, at least while the market's open, sitting glued to their screens, you know, looking for opportunities and trading. So there's that element of our business, and I'm not, you know, really actively involved in that these days just because it's so time intensive, and in order to do, you know, some other things, you know, within the business, it's difficult to do that if you're glued to a screen all day. So that's one part of what we're doing. The second part is, you know, we have a managed fund or a hedge fund, which trades, you know, longer term type strategy. So, you know, day trading isn't really appropriate for that vehicle. So, you know, our takeover strategy, which you mentioned earlier, you know, fits within the fund, plus some other, you know, kind of longer term scalable type strategies. And I guess the more recent, you know, development there is the blog that we've started to share some of, you know, our ideas, you know, some of our more simple ideas in the takeover space that, you know, retail investors are capable of implementing themselves without it having to be through our fund or, you know, needing any special help to do. But the one thing that drives all of those areas or all those business divisions is this idea of risk reward. So you know, what we're really trying to do in the first instance is make sure that we really strongly understand the downside in each situation. And, you know, I guess upside is secondary to that. I think one mistake that a lot of people make when it comes to trading is they're really thinking about, you know, what's my potential reward here? How much money can I make? And their position sizes are really dictated by, you know, what they're imagining their profits are going to be if things go in their favor. We're the complete opposite of that. We're really trying to figure out, okay, we're happy to risk X amount per trade, for a stock standard, what I'll call opportunity. And that, really dictates our position size. And I guess we'll cover the takeover thing in a little bit more detail shortly. But some of the opportunities in that space are, more interesting from a risk-reward perspective than your standard opportunity. So we have some discretion to, vary our position size accordingly in that situation. I think if you're pigeonholing what we're doing, I call it rules-based discretionary trading. So we have fairly fixed framework around what we're looking for in all situations, and lots of alerts and triggers and things that alert us to opportunities, but all of it has human intervention. So it's always someone looking at that saying, is that opportunity as good as it appears to be? Yes, it is, let's take it. Or alternatively, no, it's not for X, Y, and Z reason, and therefore we're not taking it. Probably the best example I can give of a trade where I think that the reward is outsized relative to the risk. It's one we did recently for our fund and through our newsletter, through our blog. And that was in a stock called Panos. Australia PNA was the ASX code. And the history of Panos very briefly was that they had a copper mine or several copper mines. Major shareholder was a Chinese company, had made a couple of approaches to Panos previously about taking them over at higher prices than where the takeover subsequently happened. At the time, Panos board said, no, we're not interested. The price isn't high enough. We really went through that period of 6 months or so of commodity price corrections. And the major shareholder, Chinese shareholder, comes back and says, we're making another takeover offer. Takeover offers can vary quite considerably in terms of how they're structured, but the cool thing about this most recent offer for Panos was that the price at which the takeover was being made was guaranteed. So it's basically called an unconditional takeover. And I think $1.71 from memory was the takeover price. We trade so many of these, I can't remember exactly, but let's call it $1.71 for argument's sake. As soon as that takeover is announced, Panos is trading at $1.72. So you can basically buy Panos as much as you like, more or less, for a number of days at $1.72 or thereabouts, knowing fine well that no matter what happens, if there's no improved bid, even if the market tanks during that time, you're going to be able to sell that stock at $1.71. So that's really your hard stop loss that you've got in place, at least for the period that the bid exists. But it wasn't a crazy thought to think that Panos might get an improved bid, maybe not a competing bid from a different shareholder or a different company, given the reasonable shareholding that the Chinese company already had. But the bid that they'd pitched most recently was about 20 or 30% below where the bid had been pitched previously. So it wasn't ridiculous to think that the bid could be improved by 10 or 15% above its current level, in order to get board acceptance and get shareholder acceptance. So, the way that looks is that if the takeover price is $1.71 and it gets a 10% bump, and the new price becomes $1.88, if you look at that, what you were risking in that situation, you're really only risking that 1 cent per share because you can get that $1.71, yet you have the potential to, get $1.85 or $1.88 or more, potentially $2. So for us, I love that trade because I know exactly at the outset what my downside is. I've got that locked in. I can position size accordingly. And if the trade works out, then the multiple of reward relative to risk that you get is very, very great. The headline percentage, it might only be a 10% return on the capital invested. But if you look at your return on risk, if you get a bump in the share price or in the offer price, it's almost unheard of. So that's not to say that Panos was definitely going to get that better offer. It's very possible that the Chinese company just says, look, that's our best and final offer, too bad, and we lose a cent a share. But at the outset, that's a nice trade for us to take. And as it turned out, they got a bump of almost 10%. I think $1.85 ended up being the price that was taken out on. So we made 8 or 9% headline return on the trade, but had a very big position size because we had that downside built in, and we really got about 14 or 15 times what we'd risked as a return on the trade. So that in a nutshell is probably the best example I can give you of what our holy grail trade looks like.
Okay, yeah, that's really interesting. So I mean, you obviously sort of talked a lot about an example there of sort of the takeover strategy, but if we could just sort of take it back to step one, what's the general objective of this type of strategy? So let's focus in on your actual takeover strategy. What's the general objective of this?
Look, so, I mean, the general objective really is, which applies across our whole business, is to try and take lowish risk trades with good payoffs. The great thing about the takeover strategy specifically, from our perspective, but also, you know, from our investors' perspective, is that takeovers have generally pretty low correlation to the market. So once a stock is under takeover, depending on, you know, the level of conditions attached to whether the offer is likely to proceed, more often than not, it's no longer trading in line with the broader market. So you don't need to worry about having a position that, you know, you wake up tomorrow morning and the Dow is down 5%. You know, your takeover positions just aren't going to get sold off, or if they do, they shouldn't be, and it corrects itself pretty quickly. So it's a really low volatility strategy for us in terms of it has low market beta. And that's part of the reason that we actually decided to put it in a fund and that, you know, we've rolled it out through the blog because, you know, I think there are a lot of people out there, certainly in Australia this is evident, you know, maybe less so in the US, but I presume it's, you know, a similar issue. Lots of investors who, you know, have had share market risk previously or have it now, and they really don't want the volatility that goes with that. The share market's great in terms of, you know, being a trader or being an investor, holding managed funds, whatever, when it's going up. But people don't want those massive drawdowns that, you know, you get in a GFC in an extreme example, even the hit that our market took and that, you know, I guess a lot of global markets took last week when we had the dual issues of China's market falling over and, you know, also these issues in Greece. I think, you know, people don't like that as much as in advance they may think that, you know, their risk profile is that they're happy to, you know, take some risk in order to get the upside. I don't really think that, you know, fundamentally that's the case. But, you know, at the moment, these people don't really have the choice to not be in the share market because the returns on, you know, deposits in bank accounts are so low at the moment that, especially if you're a retiree or, you know, you're getting towards retirement and, you know, you need that income to live, it's just not on offer. So, you know, what we do or aim to do with the takeover strategy is show people how to get share market-like returns with much lower volatility or downside risk than what that would usually entail. So, you know, we definitely have strategies that we can make more money with, but the returns are more volatile. You're going to, you know, experience larger drawdowns and probably more frequent drawdowns. The cool thing about the takeover strategy is you don't really tend to get those drawdowns or big drawdowns because you're not linked to the market as such. There are other factors at play. And if you're pretty good at figuring out what those factors are and only taking those trades where you're comfortable that the risks are minimal, you should have pretty low market beta using this strategy.
Okay, right. So how do you find out if a company is about to be taken over? And how do you sort of know if whether how true that is? Like, is it possible that it could be a false rumor?
Yeah, well, the great thing about the strategy, at least as we run it, is that it doesn't require knowing in advance. So our strategy actually is that we wait until the takeover has been announced and it's formal, and then we buy the shares. And that might seem counterintuitive because, you know, what you think about is you want to buy a share today that gets a takeover bid tomorrow at 40% above its current price and you make money. The thing about that is it's very hard to predict. So, of course, there are rumors. I mean, if it's a genuine rumor and you really know the information, then, you know, you have it illegally at that point. And so that, you know, kind of rules out that option. If it's a rumor, you know, you're undoubtedly not the only person who knows that rumor and who knows how true it is. And, you know, if you're just buying stocks purely because they're perhaps going to be subject to takeovers, you don't get that smoothness of return or that lack of volatility that I was talking about earlier. And there are definitely funds out there who buy stocks that they think could become subject to takeover. What we're really interested in is buying stocks that are already under takeover that may get an improved bid and or a counter bid from another party. So if you think about it like an option, I guess, you know, anyone who kind of has basic knowledge of options knows that there are various factors that go into pricing an option. One is volatility of the underlying security. Obviously, the time that until expiry of that option, interest rates play a factor, and so on. But we're taught that time value has, or that time has value in an option. And the great thing about these takeovers is that you're buying this option, it's a synthetic option, over future upside in the share price because of an improved or competing offer. But you're not really paying for that in the way that you would normally pay for an option. So if you find like a listed option, over a security, they're pretty efficiently priced, right? There are market makers in that market, and everyone knows the Black-Scholes formula, and there's not too much variation in terms of it. It's hard to buy cheap options, but that's one way that we can buy options, synthetic call options, very cheaply over a takeover situation. And I think if we're really boiling down why the strategy works, that's it, because we're getting the ability to participate in an upside quite cheaply, which isn't to say that you always get a better offer or that you get a competing offer. You definitely don't. But you get enough of them, and in some instances, the offers or the subsequent offers are so good that you only need two or three great trades like that a year, a bunch of okay trades, and you make more than enough money every year from that strategy. So at a fundamental level, that's what we're doing. So we're not trying to anticipate who's going to be taken over. We just wait for the announcement that someone is being taken over, make sure that we think it's a credible target, a credible bidder, that the downside is known and limited, and then position accordingly in the hope that something else is going to happen.
Right, okay. And with this particular strategy, what's sort of the time frame we're looking at from when we get into a position and when we exit completely? What's the sort of holding time of one of these trades, generally speaking?
Sure. Look, I'd say probably minimum a month, and 6 months. Get 6 to 9 months would sort of be the maximum time period typically, and I'd say about 3 to 4 months on average. So if a bid is made today for a company and there are no further developments, meaning that there's no improved bid, there's no competing bid, usually they take about 3 months to come to a natural conclusion. If the share price improves in the interim, we may look to exit the position early if we think that the risk reward is no longer in our favour, or that the additional benefit by waiting those extra months is now not sufficient. If you start to get competing bids or improved bids coming in, as part of the trade, usually would get bumped out to 6 months, maybe 9. But the good news is typically that the longer the trade's going for, the more money you're making along the way, as in the a trade that you have open 6 months from today doesn't have the same bid level that it had when you took the trade. There's chances are being 1, 2, 3, 4 improvements in the bid along the way.
Right, okay. No, that's really good. So what I might do is, but obviously before the interview, you sent me through a PDF document which had sort of a bit of an overview of the strategy we've just sort of discussed here, the takeover strategy. And it had a few case study examples in there as well. So I might put a link to that in the show notes. So if anyone wants to find out more about this, just go to chatwithtraders.com and you'll find it in the show notes below the interview. But let's keep this moving. So I'm keen to ask you just kind of some general advice. So from your experience, what are some of the common mistakes you see new traders making when they come to the market?
Look, I think there's a few things. I think a lot of people maybe think that it's easier than it is, depending on what experience they've had up until that point in time. So, you're at a barbecue and, your buddy tells you about some stock that he bought 3 weeks ago and it's up 25 or 30%, someone else who's in your family who, has been day trading. I guess this is a big thing around 2000, who's, making $3,000 a day and they've quit their job or whatever. And I think you're looking at those people going, wow, this is, pretty easy. Maybe you've, bought a stock or two yourself, same thing, you're making money. And then all of a sudden you're not. And usually that's because, people are making money without necessarily knowing why they're making money. Luck is definitely a factor, right place, right time. Obviously, if the market's going up, you know, generally and going up strongly, then rising tide lifts all boats, and it's sort of easy to make money. Somewhere along the way, inevitably that reverses. I think, you know, some people, if they're trading a specific stock, you know, maybe they paid 50 cents for it and, you know, saw it get as high as 70, and, you know, now it's back to 35. So it must be great buying now because it's been to 70 before. You know, I should buy more. I should hang on to my existing position, you know, whatever. And then they lose money. So I think, you know, that's sort of one thing is that, and I think in life generally, it's easy to look around at other people and assume they're having more success than you are, or that, you know, they've got something that you don't. And, you know, I think it's, as they say this about gamblers, right? You always hear about gamblers' winnings, but you never hear about their, you know, the times that they lose. I sort of feel like, not necessarily intentionally, but family and friends, you know, maybe, and even brokers who don't have your best interest at heart are telling you about all the times that, you know, you missed out on making money because you're not trading shares. So I think that's an element of it. You know, not necessarily having a plan around, you know, downside, like how much money am I willing to lose on this position or on, you know, a series of trades before I revisit what I'm doing. You know, where's my stop loss on this trade? Like, where am I wrong and where am I getting out of it? You know, what flows on from that is, you know, getting stopped out of a position because you know you're supposed to and you've had the discipline to be stopped out. And then you watch the share rebound strongly to, you know, higher than where it was trading before. So then you think, oh, well, if I didn't have that stop loss, I'd be making so much money now. So, you know, maybe I shouldn't have stop losses in future, or maybe I should not pay attention to my stop losses. And then it all becomes a bit wishy-washy because it's like, well, okay, I've got this stop, but, you know, how do I decide whether I'm executing it or not? Is that just something I decide at the time based on how I feel and my, you know, intuition? Or so look, you know, there's that. I think, so on one hand, I think that's people underestimating how difficult it is to consistently make money. But I think the flip side of that is that, you know, you look at the market and you think about the people who are participants in that market. So I'll use Goldman Sachs as the gold star example in terms of, you know, at least their profitability and their resources and whatnot, you know, all the way down to smaller, I guess, day traders or swing traders who are individuals who do that for a living. I think you can assume that that can be really difficult, and you can go to, you know, a lot of these courses you go to, that I've had exposure to in the early years by, you know, going along and watching them. I've had exposure in my later years by being one of the presenters or speakers at these events. And, you know, some of the things that these people talk about, when you, you know, pay for these seminars, it just sounds so complex and so difficult. And, you know, you can walk away thinking that if you can remember those, you know, 300 different chart patterns that, you know, you're definitely going to make money, or if you can, you know, master the 50 fundamental analysis ratios that, you know, you read in the book, that you're going to be able to make money. Or and you know that if you can't do those things, that then that means you can't be successful. I think that's a big mistake for beginners as well. I think, you know, either assuming you can do what everyone else is doing and it just works out is, I think, a mistake. And but also assuming that it's impossible to do what the very best are doing is a mistake. And I think, you know, probably fear and greed, you know, drive both of those things, as they do, you know, in the markets generally. I think, you know, if I was giving a new person advice, I mean, obviously you have to learn somehow, right? So you learn by reading, you learn by going to seminars. Sometimes you learn by doing and maybe losing a little bit of money. But I think it's all part of the journey to try and understand. I listened to, you know, the interview that you did where you talk about GAN and how much time you spent kind of studying that in the early days, and, you know, reading the books, and you've been to the seminars and whatever. And then somewhere along the way, you just kind of figured out that, you know, maybe it wasn't all that you thought it was, or maybe it wasn't for you. And the good news is, by the sounds of things, it didn't really cost you much in terms of dollars, maybe a bit of time to get to that point. And I think that you need to learn and have some exposure to all of those things. But I think you just need to understand that nothing is as great as it seems from the outside looking in, as in there is no perfect thing in the markets that is always going to make you money, that, you know, you can master and then that's it. It just doesn't work like that. And unfortunately, I think that, you know, in our industry, there are some people who are holding themselves out as experts who are anything but, they're experts at presenting courses and, you know, providing education and, you know, really know the ins and outs of the 300 chart patterns and systems that you know, I referred to earlier, who either haven't really traded a share, you know, a day in their life, or they have, but not particularly successfully, and they figured out that, you know, it's better for them to be educators. And I have no problem with that if it's on a disclosed basis that, you know, you're not holding yourself out to be something that you're not. But I think that's a big trap for new people, is that, you know, you want to grab someone and hold on to them as the person you need to be like. And it's definitely important to have, you know, role models and mentors and whatever else. I would just say that, you know, attaching yourself to probably to the right people is important, but, you know, kind of just being a little bit skeptical about everything. I'd like to think I'm an optimist in life generally, but I feel in the market you have to just be a little bit skeptical and a little bit neurotic, because sometimes things that look too good to be true, you know, actually are too good to be true, and sometimes you know, things that look too good to be true actually are real and can be exploited. But at the start, it's hard to figure that out, and you sort of don't want it to cost you too much money, you know, real money, to kind of get to that point and figure it out. So I think, you know, thinking that you can just turn up and do a course or two and become a great trader is a pipe dream. But, you know, alternatively, you don't have to be a mathematical genius or, you know, the smartest person in the room to be able to make money from the markets, because there's lots of different ways. You just have to, you know, get to the point where you understand how you're going to make money and what's going to stop you from making money.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's such a good answer, Luke. Really, really good points you hit on there. Let's just do one more question, and then we should probably wrap this up. So, I'm interested to know, this is a little bit different. Besides your blog, of course, the long and the short of it, are there any blogs or resources that you yourself frequently visit or use to stay in tune with the market?
Yeah, look, there definitely are lots of, I guess, different resources. It's probably one thing about, you know, my job that I think people from the outside wouldn't appreciate is how much time you just have to spend reading things and learning about things, most of which ends up, to be perfectly honest, being completely, you know, useless or non-usable, at least at the time. But you can only uncover things by going looking for them. And sometimes you'll, you know, maybe pick something up today that you can't use, but in 6 months or 12 months, you'll be able to use them. So, I mean, look, in Australia, definitely the Australian Financial Review I read every day, the business section of all of our major newspapers, so the Australian, Sydney Morning Herald, I read the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, Bloomberg, CNBC. I get a bunch of kind of emails daily that summarize financial news and whatnot. And then just ad hoc things that, you know, maybe I'll come across depending on what sort of trades we're working on at the time. But I think being, you know, well-read in terms of regular content, but, you know, also some of those great classic trading books. I mean, I know you interviewed Jack Schwager a couple of weeks ago. You know, I think if I think about my favorite trading books, Market Wizards and New Market Wizards would be, you know, amongst the top five, undoubtedly, just for the insight you get to other people who are doing things that, I mean, for me, really helps solidify that there are a million different ways you can do things, different personality types, different strategies, and they all work. So, you know, I think understanding other people's journeys, where they went wrong, what strategies they've, you know, used successfully, which I guess is part of what you're aiming to achieve with this podcast, right? You're giving people exposure to different traders who have different strategies and systems, who can talk about what works and what doesn't, and maybe you learn that way rather than having to learn for yourself, which takes more time and can be more costly.
All right, that's a really great, another great answer there, Luke. So, thanks a lot for doing this, and I mean, I've certainly picked up a few things from this discussion, and I'm sure anyone listening has also. But before you go, do you want to share with listeners where they can go to find out more about you and your trading methods?
Yeah, sure. So, look, definitely you know, people can visit our blog, which we just recently established, so it's just www.longandshortofit.com.au. I'll get you to put that in the show notes, perhaps, so people can easily find it. Also, we have a managed or a hedge fund that I mentioned earlier, so that's just www.789assetmanagement.com.au. Just getting back to the blog, actually, we'll set up a promo code so that anyone who's who's listening today who thinks that, you know, maybe they'd like to trade the takeover strategy and have a bit more information sent to them, We'll do a discount there, 20% off our usual subscription, so that anyone who's interested can take advantage of that. It's actually a 14-day free trial anyway for people to have a look around before they commit any money. And then anyone who uses the promo code can get an ongoing discount on their subscription.
Good one. So what's the promo code?
It's a good question, actually. We'll put that in the show notes if that's okay. We've got one set up. I just don't have the details of it at hand.
Okay, sure. Yeah, well, of course, the promo code will be in the show notes. All the links will be also in the show notes. And are you on Twitter or anything like that?
Yeah, I am. So on Twitter, personally, I'm just at LukeCummings81. Our blog, we're set up at long short of it as well. So anyone can reach out to me that way. Obviously, get in contact via either of those websites if they'd like to do so.
That's really good. All right. Well, thanks a lot for doing this, Luke. And until next time, take care. And we'll talk soon.
Thanks, Aaron. Appreciate it. Really good to chat to you.
You've come to the end of this episode of Chat with Traders, but don't worry, more great episodes are on the way. To stay updated with each great new episode, be sure to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, and we'd love it if you leave us a rating and review. We'll see you next time on Chat with Traders.